You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
I'm watching Limp Bizkit front row with our management, with Nick Adler, the manager of our band. And I don't know what's going on. I'm just watching the show. And all of a sudden I see out of the toilet, I see Lynn's head. And then I see his chest with a big giant snot sticker. And then I see him, he's butt fucking naked. A dick out, flying 20,000 people. He hasn't got a bit of clothes on.
Hey, welcome to another episode of 2020. My name's Corey Peza. I'm here, as always, with Siobhan Cronin and Benny Goodman. What's going on, guys?
Hey, not much.
So, we talk a lot about, like, rock and roll stories, and I feel like every other one up to this point pales in comparison to what we hear on this episode.
With our guest, Mikey Doling.
And talking about the legendary Lynn Strait, if you don't know who he was, it's probably because you weren't exposed to that period of time in the 90s where a band snot ruled the airways of MTV and the radio. But Lynn Strait was a legendary guy, but he was a flash in the pan. But Mikey Doling, our guest, was the guitar player in that band, along with Soulfly and Channel Zero. And he's coming out with a new band, Wyote, that you guys need to stay tuned for.
Right, and he gets into a lot of the stories of the formation of Snot and the writing process going into the studio. Some really crazy concert stories. I don't want to give too much away, but he had us laughing.
But also, I think that he said that Shannon Larkin, who we also had on before, seems to be the key to a lot of these stories, and he kind of threw the gauntlet down. So if Shannon's listening, I think you need to come back on with Mikey at his request so that you guys can kind of both let the cat out of the bag.
Yeah, but without further ado, great episode, Mikey Doling. Check it out.
Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Benny Goodman, and you are listening to 2020, a show about a year ago. Maybe it's 2 years ago. Maybe if we're lucky, it's 3 years ago, because we're still in cyberspace somewhere and you're listening. My name is, again, Benny Goodman, to reiterate it. And if you haven't subscribed yet, 2020-D.com. I'm here with my cohorts, my compatriots, my fellow 18 plusers that could go to life in jail with me, Sebastian, and all the things that we're doing down on Skid Row. Siobhan Cronin.
Hey, how's it going, Ben?
Good. How about yourself, Siobhan?
Pretty good.
And then, good, of course, last but not least, as far as my cohorts are concerned, Corey Peza.
What's going on? I'm excited. I've been buried in mixes all day, so this is a nice welcome
break.
Yeah,
I dropped a bunch of notes on Corey, so he's been struggling, I'm sure.
And then I am so happy to say that it's come full circle. The gentleman that we have on today is actually what was my first interview with any quote-unquote famous touring rock guy. I have a picture of me and him, I think from 1997 on my
Holy
wall
shit.
Over there, 1998 or something. He's played with the legendary Snot. He has toured the world with Soulfly. He has, and of course, while doing that, toured with bands like Pantera. And he plays in a fantastic band, Channel Zero, and has a new band that he's going to tell us all about, which I listened to, which, bro, it sounds like the best of Owls and Chains. There's a little bit of that, like, power groove Pantera thing going on.
Fucking
so
A,
I just gotta
man.
Tell you,
nice.
When I was, like, vacuuming this morning, I was doing it with a little bit of a step.
Yeah, man, Wyote. Yeah.
So, ladies and gentlemen, Mikey Doling!
Hey, what's happening? All right.
Woo.
Hi, guys.
Welcome. Hey.
Thank you. I'm 3 hours behind you, and I see you have a glass of wine over there.
Oh, yep. This is my signature.
It's a little bit early for me to have wine, but get on you.
Well, listen, if you change your mind, you're in good company.
I may have to. I might have to do that. Cool.
Javon's always down to antique.
It makes this show much more tolerable, too. I can promise you that.
And I see you guys are all in, like, recording studios. You all have guitars around you. I see some amplifiers.
Figured out we're in a band. This is how we're surviving. We had to
awesome.
Pivot.
I got some guitars around me too. I got this one. I got my Beretta over there. I got my Adrian Smith Jackson Strat over there. I got my
Adrian Smith Iron Maiden shirt on.
There you go, man.
Right, representing.
On. Hell yeah.
So let's jump right on in, dude. Like,
sure.
What's been going on with you? Obviously, 2020 was a little so. you figured it out. We're in a band called Lost Symphony. Siobhan also plays in a band called Starset. And
I know all about Starset. I really
they're
like
kind
Starset.
Of a big deal. They're, she's the only reason this band, this show has any credibility.
Yeah. Congrats. That's amazing. You guys are killer.
Oh, thank
really
you.
Like
oh,
it.
Thank
2
you.
Billion
I
streams,
that.
According yeah. to the Forbes.com. You have been around for a while, just kicking ass and taking names in the metal industry. What makes you tick? How was last year? Because I know for a lot of my friends that were touring, it was like, oh, we're going to do something awesome. And then nothing.
I mean, we were going to do something awesome too. My band Channel Zero, we had an entire summer booked all the way into the fall. We were ready to rock, man. And we had festivals like Grass Pop and Alcatraz. I mean, actually it was Alcatraz and Hellfest. We had a lot of festivals booked.
No big deal.
Some pretty cool stuff. Yeah. Yeah. We had to cancel all that shit, man. It was a bummer for everybody, for all the bands out there.
So how'd you manage that? What did you do to keep yourself occupied?
Well, I actually wrote a new album, Wyote. I formed and started a new band with Aaron Nordstrom, the singer for Gemini Syndrome.
Oh, yeah. We toured with them a couple of years ago.
Killer.
Of course he did.
Well, he's a really good friend of mine. I produced his first record, actually, Gemini's first album. And
that's awesome.
Since then, we've been real close buddies, and we always wanted to do something together. And we decided to go ahead and do that and put some music together and collaborate. And it came out killer.
That's taking advantage of the situation, I'd say.
Mm-hmm. We wrote, I guess we got like 13 songs.
Nice, man.
Yeah.
So that's as amazing. Far as inspiration is concerned, like, I know you've done a lot of different things as far as going from really, really heavy, heavy rock. Like when I listened to Wyote, is that how you pronounce it? So I get it right.
I'm it's Wyote.
Okay,
yeah.
Cool. Mm-hmm. I don't want to call someone's band by the wrong name. I'm like sitting there going, have you seen Prong? No, dude. Primus? Primus is up next. But when so you sent me 2 tunes. I think it was like Digital Dream and Atlas, I want to say, which my stoner brain is not very good. So the fact that I remember it is good marketing, gentlemen.
Good job.
But I listened to it and I feel like, one, it has the power groove, which so many heavy bands are lacking now. Like they're taking that double bass, which there is some double bass, but it's not like ridiculous Gene Holgan shit. It's double bass that should be in a power groove band. But the heaviness is in the intensity of the riffs, and
absolutely.
That allows your vocalist to sing.
Yep.
And when the screams come in, when there are yelling or screaming, it's a dynamic thing. It's not like my mom's going to be angry that I'm playing it in the other room. Is there a reason? Where does that all come from, Mikey?
Well, honestly, when I started the project, I literally was listening to Alice in Chains and Pantera. And I was like, man, we need to fuse this style together.
Good job.
You know, and that's kind of what I did, man. I mean, I just did a lot of listening, you know, and picked up the guitar, and that's what came out. And fortunately, Aaron, man, his harmonies, you know, they're real dark. And Alice in Chains has that dark vibe. Mm-hmm. Not that it's the same as Alice in Chains or even is a rip.
No, but it's reminiscent in the same way that Alice in Chains is heavy, because Lane and Jerry had such great voices that they didn't have to be heavy singers for the heaviness of the riffs. And if you even listen to the guitar tone, it's not that heavy either. It's heavy in the bombast and the intensity of the riffs and the way that it grooves hard.
Right. I wasn't going for the full metal thing. I mean, I was trying to keep it pretty heavy rock. And I believe a lot of tone. I mean, if you guys record music, you know a lot of the tone comes from these, from your hands.
Say it every single
time. We talk about this all the time.
I have 170 guitars and I keep telling people I'm not getting any better. There's not one magic thing.
Right.
It's your hand.
It really is the way you lay it in there, right? And I was really depending on that. I would back down the game just a little bit on purpose, just to be able to have the dynamics, you know, when you record. And that's kind of how it came out, man. If you listen to it, like I'll be playing some heavy stuff and going to something kind of a little bit cleaner. And that's just me lightening up on it. And I think that's the way they used to do it in the old days, you know? And the music itself kind of came out like that, a little bit retro, I think.
Yeah, I got to check it out. So, I mean, the bands you're describing and the influences are basically right up my wheelhouse. It's basically all
four
of them.
I'll go ahead and forward them a couple songs, and I'll send you a third one. I got another one I just finished this weekend. We're working with the producer, Chris Collier. Do you know Chris? Have you heard of him?
That name sounds familiar.
I feel like it's familiar, but
he's killer. He did like the last Prong record. He just finished the new Korn album.
I thought it was Prone.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, Prone. Yeah, Prone. Good. But yeah, he's killer, and he's kind of got this new school approach. The way he
what
writes.
Does that mean? Tell us, well, guitar players, what that means. Well, what does a new school approach mean?
I shouldn't say new school approach. We recorded this record at his house. We weren't in some killer, big giant studio with a drum room.
How do you know that you're not just the dinosaur living in the new school?
I could be. I probably am.
That's why
I'm grayer.
Well, no, because I'm saying, because you say that, but like there are kids that are alive that have never done anything but record in basements. Talk to Billie Eilish. I don't think she had been in a real recording studio.
Right.
Meanwhile, like you're saying the new school way, but it's like, is that the new school way or is that just the new way?
Well, unfortunately, I mean, I love going in a big drum room with a big console. Don't get me wrong, you know, but with the COVID and studios are actually kind of dying off. To walk in with this dude and he just programs the drums right there, what I want to hear, and they sound fucking real as hell.
It has no personality as a person, though, right? The drums don't talk back at you.
They do. They yell at me a little bit in my head.
Then
they
what's
do.
The point of
They're
programming?
Like, dude, what the fuck?
No, but it's amazing that you can.
None of the crash. It's on the ride, man. Yeah.
So how was that experience, though? You know, going from the bigger studios to doing it in a more stripped down way.
God, there's pros and cons, you know. I really like just sitting in front of the console, and I know a lot of musicians would kick my ass with this, like, oh, that's bullshit, man. But I like sitting in front of the console and just combing it out and just keep combing it. You know, I'm not feeling that. Let me try this, try that. All right, strip that.
Is that why all your records cost so much money?
No, it's actually cheaper. It's actually much cheaper. Yeah, because you don't have the big drum room and all that, and it's more comfortable, and you can go take a lunch. Mm-hmm. You're not paying hourly rate. You're at somebody's house.
Oh, I thought you were talking about sitting in the giant consoles.
Which one?
Like in the mixing room, right?
Oh, yeah, in the mixing room. Yeah,
well, back in the old days, it was really fucking expensive. You know, like when I did the Snot record, we did that. I mean, it's 20 years ago.
Longview Farm Studios in North Brookfield, Massachusetts.
Yeah, brother, that was $200,000. Sitting in that place recording.
$1,500 a day.
Yeah,
they fed
exactly.
your ass. They totally screened all your calls. There was a there's a Cat Stevens steam room.
There was
a room for Keith Richards that didn't have any windows, but it had opaque lights that appeared to be windows, but he had specifically requested no sunlight.
Dude, I know the room well. Yes.
Right. So, and they had horses. So, like, I remember one time I got high in, like, the barn, and they said, listen, we don't care if you get high, but don't get our horses high.
Wait a minute. You were at that studio, Longview?
Not only did I record my first record there, I actually had moonlit there while you, Cold Chamber, Seven Dust, a lot of bands were there. And in fact, the guy that fixed the headstock on one of my Gibsons played banjo on your Snot record.
Oh, that's fantastic. I think we had that conversation before. Yeah, there's a stable. Sorry, we got off subject from the other record, but this
welcome
record,
to our show.
No, no, no. Oh, yeah, this is.
Let's go
classic.
Back to 96 when we did that record. The whole entire band lived in the studio, and just under the studio, there's a stable with horses in it. And then under that, there's a house. So it's just the craziest place. Oh, no,
it
excuse me.
It burned down twice. It's also haunted.
The house is actually next door. That would be crazy if there was horses on the
house. Yeah.
There's a house and then there's a giant barn and they're both separate studios. The house has the Trident board that like recorded some Queen records and all that. Which, by the way, as a side note, my first recording experience ever, I went with my jazz band because apparently out of 20 years of doing jazz band, our high school jazz instructor thought that we were so good, he convinced the school to put us at Longview. And apparently it was the time that Rainbow was recording there. And I remember sitting in the console room, and I loved like Deep Purple and all that, like as a kid, thinking to myself, that dude looks like Ritchie Blackmore. And like they said that he just worked there or whatever.
This and it was.
And I found out this year from, I think it was the drummer from Rainbow, was like, no, we were recording. That was absolutely Ritchie. And I remember your jazz.
That's fucking crazy. And how about that Neve console that's in there? I mean, that thing's insane. See, there we go. All right. Yeah. I kind of like take away everything I said 10 minutes ago or 5 minutes ago. And see, I missed that side too, for recording. That console is insane, man. But
my husband was just talking about this. No, because now they have all the... No, I was saying my husband was just talking about that exact console, because now you can get all these plugins and it's like, you know, but it's not the same
as... Yeah, it's not the same as... The original.
Big tube and the tubes and the compression and all that stuff, you know, and, you know, they, I believe they even have like mastering itself kind of in the console. Not the end mastering, but some, you know, just kind of compresses the whole thing. And and
for $15, you could send your tracks and they will master them for you by putting a sonic maximizer.
Yeah, a computer will do it.
Exactly. Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that recording process at Longview and what that was like?
Oh, man, that was so good. Sure, I'd love to.
What an amazing studio.
That, you know what? Let me go grab the actual guitar that I recorded that
Please
record
do.
With.
Please
do. I'll be back in seconds.
Hell yeah.
Okay, one sec.
So first and foremost... Can you see that?
Yes.
Yvonne, can you see that?
She's
all right.
Yeah, I know.
Look at you, little kid.
That's you and me. Hold on, look at the guitar I'm holding. And then
Which guitar is that?
It's a PV Predator, but I brought it to Ozfest and had every single member of every single band sign it. But when you and I did this, it wasn't even signed. That's my first guitar.
So yeah,
that's my first interview ever.
Is that on the Snobbus?
That's on the Soulfly bus. I want to say it was 98. That was my first like real 99.
So if anyone's just listening, make sure you check out the YouTube feed. It's a pretty great picture.
Actually, that's 2000. Because Soulfly headlined second stage Ozfest 2000.
So maybe that was a... No, but that wasn't Ozfest. It was at the Palladium in Worcester. And I...
Because
that guitar's from Ozfest 99. So it's before that.
Palladium in Worcester.
Yeah, you guys did that was the first Soulfly tour I think you did.
Wow. Yeah, I remember that place.
And in fact, I was supposed to do an interview with Max, and I came up to the side of the bus, and they're like, are you kidding, kid? There's no way you're talking to Max Cavalera. You could talk to Mikey.
I'm like, sure,
you're so nice to me.
Yeah, of course. Of course. Hey, look at this thing.
Is that the one you got back?
Wow.
That was like all fucked up?
Yes.
Tell everyone the story.
Sure, I'll tell you the story. This thing's beautiful, huh?
Oh my god!
Tune into the YouTube guys.
Right, so we should tell the listeners what they're looking at for anyone that's not watching.
Beautiful, beautiful, sexy Gibson Les Paul. That unless you like guitars, you just don't truly understand how much people are salivating.
I'll tell you a story about this one. Take a look again. It's just a beautiful, beautiful guitar. I recorded "Get Some" with this guitar. Snot "Get Some." In 96, and it's the only guitar I used on the album, so it's every song, every note of Get Some that I played. And Sonny had a black one. He played his parts.
Sonny Mayo.
Yes, Sonny Mayo played it on them. Yeah. How we got these guitars was when we signed, back in the old days, when you signed to a record company, there was actually money, you know?
Unlike
the current, yeah.
Yeah, they took us out to dinner. They bought us clothes. I'm not kidding. We signed to Geffen Records, the same team that signed Guns N' Roses, Nirvana, Zombie. You know, they signed us. And they spoiled the fuck out of us. And they took us to Guitar Center because they had this really shitty little beat up Ibanez with like stickers all over it. Little skater kid guitar. I mean, you know. And they took us to Guitar Center and said, pick any guitar you want off the wall. Oh, look. Hey. Hi, Jax.
Hi.
Oh, my God. Look at that hair.
Guest star. I love when the kids make a cameo. Wow. That's amazing hair. Yeah.
All right. Bye.
See you later, bro.
He bailed.
Yeah. You just got 2020 by your own kid.
Oh, yeah. Oh, he 2020s me all day. He gets embarrassed by me at school all the time.
What's his name?
Jax.
And how old is
he? Oh, cute.
He's 8. He'll be 9. In October, so he's 8 and a half. Nice. he's so cool.
Now he's playing very good reason to interrupt the guitar porn, but back to the Gibson Les Paul.
Okay, so Geffen bought us these guitars. We went, we recorded Get Some with that guitar. And then I played, I mean, if you look at any old Snot footage, that's the guitar I'm playing live. And the Ozfest stuff or any of the touring we're doing. Anyway, I played that guitar so much and threw it across the stage back in the old days. We were a little more wild than we are these days. There was beer and blood on it. We'd throw it across the stage and neck would snap.
Just mess with your guitar player's temper and go like, ha ha, his mids are going to be too much today.
Not back then. Anyway, so fast forward to like 2000, I guess it was, 2002 or three. You know, the guitar had been dead. And there's a club in Santa Barbara called the Velvet Jones. And my buddy Craig owns the Velvet Jones. Many bands have played there over the years. It was like the spot, any band going on tour through Santa Barbara, they played there. It's a club that holds like 600, something like that. So one night I'm in there drinking shots of Jaeger with them, getting way too smashed. He's like, hey, man, I actually need something of yours to hang on the wall. Because your snot's from Santa Barbara. I'm like, cool. So I gave him that guitar because it just didn't work anymore. It was just destroyed. And it sat on that wall for about 18 years. Wow. Yeah, 18 years. Wow. Right there over the bar, every band that came through, that guitar was there getting the energy off it, you know, and
nice.
Feeling it. And I guess it was 2019, they finally closed the doors on the place. Sorry. After so many years. It was 20 years that place was there. And I think he was just moving on. He just had enough, you know, 20 years of rock bands. And
well, also, you know, watching the scene completely go from amazing to like fighting tooth and nail just to stay alive.
Kind of. Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure that had a lot to do with it. Anyway, so I didn't think nothing of it. I just heard that they shut down. So I was in Santa Barbara, like right before COVID hit, you know, late 2019. And I contacted him because he's my buddy, you know, and I hadn't seen the guitar in years. You know, I forgot about it. That thing was gone. It was toast. You know, I was sitting on the wall just warping. It's a beach town. I'm sure it's just trash. And so we're eating sushi and we're drinking some sake. We're having a great time. He's like, hey, man, let's go to the parking lot, you know, on our way out. I'm like, okay. So we go out there and he takes me to his car and pops the trunk, pulls out a case and opens it. And it's this guitar completely.
Oh, wow.
He refurbished it. It's like new. That's again. Yeah.
Wow. It looks amazing.
Yeah. It's in great shape, man. I mean, yeah, it's like new.
You know? I really wish all of my come to the parking lot stories ended with a guitar.
Especially something so sentimental, you know?
Yeah.
That's an amazing, amazing gift. Like, holy crap, right?
Yeah, I'm literally teared up.
And one thing I always say, so I have a show called The Neurotic Guitarist on YouTube. Mm-hmm. And I always say that guitars that are beat up, they are like animals that you adopt. They work harder for your tone for you. And my guitars where I've had like the broken headstocks and all that, where people say like, oh yeah, they sound better. To me, my experience, they do.
Absolutely.
It's amazing.
Thank you.
So Mikey, before we go on from that, that's an amazing story. But you know, I come from a totally different world. I'm a classical violinist. I obviously play in rock bands and have gotten into sort of the metal scene, but I'm curious to hear about how you got into the music that you do and some of your background, like growing up, like, how did you end up in this genre? How did you end up as a guitar player? Like, what were some of your influences growing up?
Well, when I was, I guess, 14 years old, back in way early 80s, I'm a pretty old dude nowadays. I used to hang out at the skate shop back in the old days. You had the big wide skateboards with the big wheels, you know. But we still skated pools and stuff back then, but it was like late 70s, early 80s skater style. It was cool. It was called Bates Skates on Palm Canyon in Palm Springs.
Tony Hawk shit.
Even way before Tony Hawk, I'm sure.
Not the video game, the real guy.
Yeah, it's old school. So I was hanging out with older kids. I was 14 and all the other kids were like 19 and 18. You know, but I was cool back then. I was a little shithead, you know. And Black Flag came to town. And they were playing
Henry Rollins.
No, it was Descardina. It was pre-Henry.
Jesus, dude.
Yeah.
I didn't do my math. Sorry.
No. They it was old school, like Descardina.
That's like old school.
Yeah, it was, man. It was Chuck and Robo and It was the real deal. Old
you
school.
Mean the stuff that you see in the documentaries?
They pulled up in a van that had a car smashed in the side of it, so they couldn't even open the door. That was Black Flag.
Oh my God.
Yeah, and they had to pull the gear out of the back. That's the Black Flag I saw. Anyway, I'm 14 and I'm just blown away. I've never seen a live band before. I go in the show, and the power that was coming off that fucking stage, man, I was just like, my hair was blown back. My eyes were this big. I just couldn't believe that people made that kind of noise, you know? And there was people, they were slam dancing the old school punk style. And that was my first introduction to live rock and roll, you know?
And wow. Were you already listening to that type of music?
Yes.
Or how did you?
We were listening to the Circle Jerks, Black Flag and stuff like that. And, you know, but I'd never seen it live. I mean, that's how I became a guitarist. Like, I'm like, I got to do that. Right there, what? That's insane, you know.
The Circle Jerks, dude. That's a funny band. I remember getting a video from something called H, and it had this one video from the Circle Jerks called "I Want to Destroy You." And I remember thinking to myself, "I don't know who this band is, but I too want to destroy you." So I haven't heard that name in so long, but like, man, just brought me immediately back.
Yeah, that was kind of where I started there, and then I went to high school. And discovered AC/DC, you know, and weed.
Yeah. Like many others.
Yeah. You know. And then so I had this punk roots, but I really loved the energy of rock and roll. Mm-hmm. You know, and I was also playing the guitar at that age, and I was like, okay, punk rock guys, it's cool and all, but they're just going dare. These three bar chords, kind of sloppy, which is awesome, but I was kind of wanting to go a little further. And so Angus Young, you know, and then I discovered Iron Maiden and Judas Priest, you know, that real metal stuff. And I started learning all those records. Like I learned, you know, probably three Iron Maiden records over the summer. And then I learned three.
Important question. I'm sorry to interject.
No.
Favorite Iron Maiden songs and favorite Iron Maiden guitarist.
Well, oh shit, that's rough.
I know, it's really hard. It's like, what's your favorite child?
I mean, I really love the Paul Di'Anno era so much, you know.
I'm a fan. I love Phantom of the Opera. It's my favorite Maiden song. So
that's good. Yeah, and that actually, I mean, those guys were kind of a punk band in that time. You know, it was kind of punk rock. But then, of course, Bruce came in and just blew all our heads off. So I can't really pick. I love them both so much. And making me pick between Adrian and Dave. Come on, man, that ain't fair.
I got to tell you, I've made a decision in my older years. I love them all.
Adrian
Smith. Yeah, see, exactly. See,
I got his guitar. Should I grab it? All right.
You should, dude. Yes. Anyway, so everyone knows while they're listening, Adrian Smith, and there's a reason for this. Dave Murray is the bombast of Iron Maiden, where he's just like the speed of notes, and he's got this crazy blues thing going on. And then you have Janet Gers, who came in later, who's great. He's kind of like a mixture of the two, but Adrian Smith is more of the like classical, really well thought out, like most music. I want to say like music theory based Maiden player. He's tastiest.
Ben, you need to do a masterclass on the rock and roll history, because I feel like I would learn so much. Like I need the entire canon of like rock and metal history through Benny Goodman.
Here's Adrian Smith's guitar. This is his signature. And yeah, I guess I don't have a dig.
I love that Jackson logo where it's just like too big for the headstock.
Isn't that cool? Isn't that cool? Yeah, I like that too. I love the black hardware too.
Yeah. Have you heard his new tune, Adrian Smith with Richie Kotzen?
I sure have. I have, yes.
What do you think of hearing stuff like, you know, two of your favorite guitar players from the 80s now doing tunes together and like the pipes on those dudes?
Amazing. Incredible. But anyway, let's get back to what I was trying to finish there.
Yeah, no, he always tries to derail
this
my
is what
questions.
I do. I derail
it's normal.
Well, no, then I was in high school, Maiden, all that stuff. And then I moved up to Santa Barbara from Palm Springs. I had a girlfriend who was going to college up there. And Palm Springs, just it was kind of beat down back then. They didn't really have a music scene so much. They had kind of a little one, but not really. So I thought, cool, Santa Barbara, which is 2 hours north of L.A., but I'm like, L.A., you know, that's where I need to be. I just was so young, I didn't know, you know. So we ended up in Santa Barbara, and little did I know, there's an amazing music scene up there. Amazing, full of talent. There's so many bands up there. And I started this like thrash metal band. I guess that was.
And this was in the 80s, right? I mean, that there was a huge scene developing in the 80s, right?
86, yeah. It was insane. 86, from 86 to 92, I guess, I had this thrash metal band. And we did good, man. We played with everybody from Pantera to, I mean, everybody. White Zombie. We play with Alice in Chains.
So what's it like being in a band?
Testament and then Forbidden.
Like, yeah, going on stage before a guy like Alex Skolnick or a guy like Dimebag Darrell, or being able to stay on the side of the stage. Like, do you look back now and say, like, this doesn't even seem real?
I got a story, a better story for it. Yeah, it didn't seem real watching back then. It didn't. But if you want to fast forward, I'll tell you a good story about that very thing. I guess this was 7 years ago, we were playing in, I guess it was Germany, Channel Zero, my band Channel Zero. Mm-hmm. It was Belgium, excuse me. We're playing with Zach. The band's pretty big out there in Belgium. So Zach, Black Label Society, were playing right before us. Okay. Wow. Imagine me backstage listening to fucking Zach Wilde shredding 50,000 people, and I got to go on next. So I'm like,
well, hopefully they have bad taste in Belgium, right?
Like, yeah, exactly.
But I will tell you, Zach Wilde can fucking, like, overwhelm you. I one time saw Zach at the Hendrix
Experience.
It's pretty
intense, yeah.
And he not only played so long, I had to go take a piss. He saw me from the stage, walked off the stage, blocked me, stepped on my jacket, stepped on the fucking chair, and then start shredding in my face so I can't get out of the fucking aisle.
He's like, how dare you fucking walk away?
No, and then when I thought he was going to turn around, instead he just puts his guitar behind his head. And then when I went backstage later, I said, Zach, how the fuck do you play for so long, so consistently? Because not only did he like walk from the stage, play behind his head, and he's still just doing better than any of us could ever do in their wildest dreams, he's not even thinking about it. And he just looks at me and he goes, you got to do it a bunch of times with this hand. You got to do it a bunch of times with this hand. When you're tired with this hand, you got to start again with this hand.
It sounds
jerking
about
off.
Right.
Yeah. That sounds gross, but okay.
That's exactly what Zach Wilde said to me, deadpan.
But it was more with a New Jersey accent. You kind of just
I have no accent.
It was more of a, I don't want to do it. Anyway, that dude, I'll tell you how he did that, because he's the best guitar player in fucking rock and roll today. He's the man, Zach Wilde. So I'm backstage shitting
Yngwie
my pants.
Yngwie won't agree with you.
Fuck Yngwie.
Stop derailing the conversation, Ben. Let him talk.
I do. I love Yngwie too, but Zach, man, he's the whole deal, man. I love him so much, man. Anyway, so let's go back. Where were we?
Well, so let me ask you this. So I feel like you skipped a big part, which is how you learned to play. Because, you know, we went from like, okay, I saw live music and I'm amazed by this. And then all of a sudden you're opening for all these big people, you're traveling. So what was the connection? Like, how did you learn how to play guitar? Like, what was that process like for you?
Oh my God, man.
You don't have to go into crazy detail. I'm just curious because I'm a school musician. So it's very square from the classical world.
It's like any musician, you would know. From the time I was 14, 15, I was insane about it. I would stay home and I would play 8, 10 hours a day. It's all I did, right? It's all we do when you're a kid. I mean, I don't do that anymore.
Still all that I do.
Yeah, I was a better guitar player when I was a kid probably than now, because all I did was fucking play the goddamn thing. And that's how you get better, right? And I was always learning other bands' music when I was a kid. Like, I just learned, like I said, all the Maiden, Priest, the AC/DCs, and later, you know, trying to learn some of that Pantera stuff with Zach, with Dime. But that's how I learned, just playing like fucking crazy.
Yeah. And then how did you start your first band, or what was the process of actually perform, like getting into your first performance?
Oh, well, back to Chronics, the band in Santa Barbara. Right when I moved to Santa Barbara from down in Palm Springs, I guess it was 86, something like that. And I was a kid still. And it was right out of high school. And I met these guys, some local like show I found where the musicians hang. And we were kind of in a circle, maybe smoking a dude or drinking a beer or whatever. And somebody mentioned that they are starting a band. And I was like, hey, Do you need a guitar player? You know, and it happened, and that's how we formed Chronix. And then we kicked ass around town for years, and this really cool club opened up in Isla Vista, which is just north of Santa Barbara, actually adjacent to it. And every fucking buddy played there, man. You name it, from the Bay Area thrash metal days, like Testament, Exodus, Death Angel, you know, just all those bands, Violence, you know. So we got to open up for all of them.
So you got any good stories? Any crazy
any good
shit that
Alex
went down?
Skolnick stories? Because we should probably
yeah, we're
tie
gonna
this
talk
in.
To him
because
in a
no, we're talking to Skolnick, but he plays on a few of our songs on our next record. So,
I don't have any.
I'm
Alex,
reading his book right
I
now.
I don't have any Alex stories. He wasn't much of a wild child. I mean, the Exodus guy.
He was too busy. He was too busy practicing guitar in the back
with this hand and this hand.
Yeah, that hand and that hand.
But you know, the stories I got was hanging out with Rick and Holt, man. He was awesome from Exodus. Our rehearsal space was across the street from the venue.
And by the way, so people don't get lost, Gary Holt also played with Slayer for years. So even though
right.
a lot of people don't
Rick
know him from
Gary.
Exodus, he was the guy that took over for the Holy Hanuman.
Right. Yes, he did. Anyway, they would come and play down there, and a couple times he would come over to our rehearsal space, and we would party way out of control with that guy. So we had some good stories with him. But anyway, we opened up for Alice in Chains back in the day before they got big. I saw Corrosion there, Pantera a number of times. What was it? Prong. I saw that. I saw that.
That's the first band I ever saw was Prong.
Cool.
It's a true story.
That place kind of like that venue and that band honed my whole career because I learned everything about it. When we would play there, headlining ourselves, 600 kids would come and full mosh pit, stage dive and the whole thing. We were just a local band, you know. And then we broke up. Because, we got sick of each other after 5 years, as bands do. Plus, we're young and wild. And then I started Snot out of that, in that area. That's another story, but yeah.
Yeah, so how,
well, let's
how did
hear
that,
it.
Yeah, how'd that come about?
Wait, are you from Canada?
No.
Oh,
you do kind of have a Canadian twang, Corey.
You said how'd that come about? I thought you said boat. Sorry.
We're hanging around been hanging around Kelly and our Canadian guitarists too much.
And we actually had an episode where we were supposed to do a Canadian. I think Paul specifically said we were supposed to do Canadian stereotypes because he is from Canada and works for W5, which is like the biggest. It's like the 2020 the show in Canada. And he was basically we were talking about poutine.
Well, later when you edit this. Listen to that. You didn't say boat. Boat?
All right. New England is kind of close to Canada, I guess.
I guess.
So anyway, during Chronix, there was this this other band, and they're kind of more punk rock, called Lethal Dose. And we used to play with them. Not real close friends with them, but we knew the band, and we were kind of competitive with them. And then when Chronix broke up, I was like, all right, that's it. I'm starting something new. I'm not doing thrash metal anymore. It was kind of dying anyway. It was like Nirvana had came in, 94, And I was like, I'm going to just do something totally different. And I started Snot. I had a couple dudes that didn't end up being in the band later. And we found Lynn Strait, who the singer for Snot. And he was the bass player. He was the bass player in Lethal Dose. That's why I brought them up. And so we started Snot and we had a couple other members and Lynn and I, kicked those guys out. Actually, those guys are the reason Lynn's in the band because when he tried out for the band for Snot, I wasn't feeling it crazy enough. And those guys were like, no way, dude, he's a total rock star. Are you kidding me? And I was like, all right.
Kind of fine, we'll take the legendary Lynn straight into our band.
Right, totally. And then he was in the band for like 2 months, and he's like, "Dude, we got to boot these guys. Get a real band."
It was a coup d'état. Yeah.
It really was. So we, so I'm getting ready to tie something really cool in here because I know you had this man on your show. So then I went over to my buddy Shannon Larkin's house
from Godsmack and from Ugly Kid Joe,
exactly,
and Wrathchild America.
Can't forget
that. And of course, the Apocalypse Blues Band, now that he's been dubbed the Apocalypse.
And Souls at Zero.
He filled in for Black Sabbath.
Oh yeah, he did do that. Anyway,
and Sully Erna's personal drummer.
So let's talk about Apocalypse too. Let's give them a plug, man. That's really cool. They got a new record.
Yeah, theapocalypsebluesrevival.com.
Yep, there you go. Yeah, totally. Anyway, so Shannon was in Godsmack at the time. Or excuse me, in Ugly Kid Joe at the time. And those guys were like brothers to me, personally. And Shannon was kind of the new drummer in the band. You know, they had Mark Davis, who did the first albums and blew up UKJ with that. And then they got the mighty Shannon Larkin on the drums. And I remember I was trying to form this band and I was struggling. And I went to see Ugly Kid Joe's new drummer at their rehearsal. And there's Shannon Larkin, shaved head. He's got tattoos like all over his head, if you ever seen him. And this is pre tattoos on the face and head. Okay. Yeah. And he was swinging that slink back. And I was like, that's the drummer I want. This guy, he's so incredible. So I got real close with him. We have a lot of the same interests. He loves punk rock music, so do I. Even though we're metalheads, we got that punk roots, you know. And we ended up growing down. So when I was looking for members of the band one night, Shannon and I were over at his house drinking beers. It's like, you know what? I think I got guys that you need in Snot. And we weren't even started really yet. We just had the name. We played a couple like parties with these other dudes, but it really wasn't happening yet. So he put on this VHS tape, you know, and it was
of Betamax.
Yeah. And it was his band called the MF Pitbulls, motherfucking Pitbulls, back home where he's from on the East Coast.
Hold on. That's fucking crazy. Can I just stop for one moment?
Yeah.
We have David Abruzzese from Pearl Jam. We have him, and I sent you a video serving Shannon because Shannon was a fan of David. And I said, okay, well, he's been on the show. Why don't we tell him? Mm-hmm. And I made David watch Shannon's episodes. And Shannon, one of the things he said was, I would love to come back on and talk to that guy. And David sent him a video, which is him looking through a lava lamp, like all, which if you know Shannon Larkin, like this is totally on brand with Shannon, you know, basically daring him, saying the last time he saw him was when he was wearing a boa constrictor in 1980 with Rat Child America. And maybe it's time we caught up.
Awesome.
But the reason I was getting to all of that was the fact that like, you come from a time where it was Snot and all of that. He was talking about, you know,
the MF Pitbulls, right?
The MF, dude, I lost it. Thank you. The MF Pitbulls. Dave has something, a band called the International Motherfuckers.
Uh-huh.
And so, and they're like, he plays with guys from, I want to say, Mick Jagger's band. Like, mm-hmm. These are like serious cats he plays with. And then you have Shannon Badass. Doing, with his
MF.
Yeah, with the, it's so many, and then Candlebox versus Dave Cruz. Like, it's like, they're meant to serendipitously meet. I don't know if Shannon has seen the video yet. I sent it to Kamal, the Godsmack's photographer. And I was like, please show this to Shannon. But the gauntlet has been thrown down. But the reason I say that is that those guys, having not known them, are like totally the same wavelength of crazy.
Wow. Wow.
Like
wow,
literally, like David, just so you know, is an undisclosed location. He left the United States. He went away from things. He goes around the volcano on his scooter. That's all you know. He bangs on drums all day. Like, he loses his phone for a month at a time. He's out of his mind. And then all of a sudden, he'll send me a video of him in a pool floating around on a duck.
It's like, gotta be Iceland or Hawaii. That's cool.
Well, listen, yeah. I can't tell you. But then you have Shannon telling us that he's like fucking Theodore Roosevelt with his fucking goddamn koi fish and his turtles.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm
yeah.
like, you, and then his fucking room is just all like, you know,
he painted his house black. His entire house is black. Like when you drive by, it's a black house
outside. Wow.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's
in
amazing.
Florida.
You'll definitely know where he lives now. Cause there probably isn't a single black house anywhere else. In Florida.
But anyways, Earth motherfuckers,
like,
find it
before we went off way off there. We can get back to,
oh yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So, I was going to Shannon's house and we were doing some beers. I was like, I need some guys. I'm starting this punk band or this band called Snot. I had some demos that I recorded, you know, just with me playing everything, you know. And I played it for Shannon. He was like, holy crap, man, I got the guys. So he put in this beta or VHS, and it was the other three dudes that would end up being Snot. So actually, he handed me half of Snot as a bro. I owe it to Shannon Larkin, a big thank you. Because he brought in Tumor, John Fondlestock, Tumor bass, Sonny Mayo, guitar, and Jamie Miller, who's in Bad Religion now, on drums. And that's what made Snot, like, you explode. Once we got those guys in the band, it was on. We started writing and playing shows in L.A. We took over fucking L.A. like quickly. I mean, within like 3 or 4 months, we're selling out the Whiskey, the Roxy, Troubadour, just packed. It was like it just happened. It was very cool. And then we signed the deal. And
that's great. Boom. And then that brings us back to you getting the guitar, and then brings you back to Longview Farm Studios, where we were supposed to tell some stories about.
Exactly.
While you were at Longview Farm Studios, you came and played a place called the Espresso Bar in Worcester, November 27th, 1997.
Force Fed Shovelhead opened up that show.
And Seven Dust. And I say that only because it was the first time I went to two shows in a night.
Was that with Seven Dust?
Yes. Fish was playing at the Worcester Centrum.
I remember
and
that.
I had tickets to that. And then I ran to the Espresso Bar and had one of my friend's parents pick me up because I wasn't old enough to drive.
I love how they called it the Espresso Bar.
And then I came back to catch the second part of the Fish set because you can just go in because they were dirty hippies and they didn't care. 1997, while you were at Longview Farm Studio. So that was the first time I saw Snot. And I've had this on my wall
since 1997. Cool. Look at that. That's so amazing. Wow.
If you look at that, you can see it's Clint and Morgan.
Yeah,
and
I see LJ on there. And I see mine actually on the bottom. I say
Mikey 97.
Yeah. Wow. That's pretty cool. Mikey.
We've come full circle from the beginning of our episode here.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah. Tell us about that experience with Snot at the studio and what that was like in a real studio, not a bedroom.
Well, as Snot with the three members that Shannon introduced me to, and we became brothers. We all moved into the same house in Santa Barbara. We lived in a beach house in Santa Barbara. We had a rehearsal spot next to a strip club. And think about that. We all lived in one place, rehearsal, strip club. They would end up at our house. It was fun. It was a good time, man. We were the band.
What a life.
Oh man, it was crazy. And we would rehearse, like we were crazy about rehearsal. We'd get up in the morning and we'd go practice 3 hours, and then we'd go home and chill for a few hours, eat, and go back for 3 hours. We were really into it. And we wrote Get Some basically in that time. What were you asking? I'm sorry.
You mentioned that you wanted to talk a little bit about your time at Longview.
There we go. Yeah.
Talk
so
about a drum room, dude.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Well, anyway, so we signed the deal with Geffen. Lynn is a complete maniac. He can't just be in a studio in LA because then you would never get him to the studio. He'd be running around chasing chicks, chasing drugs, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll, the real deal. So they put us in Longview Farm, which is Brookfield, Massachusetts, in the woods. There's no going anywhere for him. So they put us in the studio, and we move in. We all pick a bedroom. I mean, like you said, Aerosmith, the Rolling Stones, Bad Brains, they all recorded at this place. We were stoked. It has that Neve console we were talking about earlier. And the stable underneath, which when the horse would walk at night, the whole place would shake. It was pretty
creepy. That's so scary.
It was pretty creepy. Yeah. Anyway, but it was big, big barn. It was cool. Excuse me. So, hold on a sec.
Yep. Take your time.
So, anyway, you want some of that, Jax? My son's going to drink coffee, like doing a shot. you gotta drink in front of them.
You gotta take an honorary shot.
That's shot of coffee.
It's brave of you.
Coffee. Anyway, I shouldn't do that. Bad dad. It's good.
It's very good.
Okay, now go.
It's a little bitter, but then a little sweet.
Oh yeah, we'll go play Call of Duty. Shoot people.
You should write a book on parenting.
I know.
Number one.
Have some coffee. Go play Call of Duty.
Here's some coffee. Go shoot people.
Wake up and kill them.
Anyway, so we're in Longview, and it was pretty cool how we set it up. we had, you've been to Longview, so you know that there's an adjacent like room off the studio side there. That's the drum room. We set up all the gear in there. So we had the amps, the bass, the guitar, all mic'd up, and we go in there and we would jam, man, and get a jam on a song. And the producer, T-Ray, who produced like Betty from Helmet, he did a bunch of cool records. He would tell us when we're ready. He'd go, play it again. No, play it again. You know, the producer thing.
Yeah.
Kicked our ass, you know.
Were these songs written prior to the studio or?
Yeah. Like okay, I said, we rehearsed so much. We walked in there so ready.
Right.
Yeah. We were ready to kill. The record you hear is actually exactly how we sounded live before we walked in that. It was so real.
That's great. Yeah.
Yeah. If you listen to it, there's no doubling.
That's awesome.
We tracked on the right, on the left, guitar, bass, drums. That was it.
Well, that's the old school thing that you were talking about, because that room, so people know, is like a 60-foot ceiling. It's an A-frame barn. And then the actual drum riser is actually a story above the band, as every drummer thinks in their head that they're above everyone. They literally are. So you can kind of have your separation and you get like, you know, no standing waves because the room's a giant fucking room. And you could just set up everyone strategically, get all the microphones. And that was a time where you actually had to rent the microphones separately from the studio and rent the guy separately from the studio. And if
They had all that shit there though.
Well, the label guaranteed paid them to have separate people bring them in.
Yeah, I'm sure they didn't have any of that. For sure.
But that room, you could record a live record and make it sound like that.
But anyway, we actually didn't record it live, though, because I'm getting to the story. We would just do it, and one of us would kind of fuck up. And just, it was, you know, finally the drummer, Jamie Miller, who's in Bad Religion now, awesome drummer. He was like, hey, guys, why don't you guys all go fuck off? And he recorded the entire record without us, with no music. He was just from memory.
He's like, I know it now.
From memory, he played the entire album like in 4 hours. He's like, all right, next one. Boom, boom, boom. There's no Pro Tools back then.
Yeah.
He recorded it. And then we came in, tracked the guitars over. It was perfect. I mean, the feel was there. He just had it in his head. The guy's super good and super crazy. So that's a pretty good story, is how we recorded that record, you know. But like I said, I would come in, do my side. Sonny would come in, do his side. There was no doubling, you know, just one per side. And then Tumor, our bass player, would come in, and you heard his bass tone. It's fucking insane.
Yeah. It's ridiculous.
Yep. And then,
can you talk about? Oh, sorry. No, go ahead.
No. What were you gonna say? Talk about.
I was gonna ask. Can you talk a little bit about the writing process? I'm curious. Like, you know, you said you were rehearsing a lot. Obviously, you had a really great band chemistry. What was it like to write? Like, how did that process work for you guys?
What happened was, my son's singing.
Yeah. He's all hyped up on caffeine now.
Totally. It's exactly what it is.
Anyway, I want to sing while I kill people.
I'm screaming.
Anyway, how it was. He's the best. Anyway, we signed a record deal with Geffen Records, you know? And hold on. I'm going to close that door. One second.
That's okay.
I love, as he walks away, if you guys go on to the video, he's got his band Channel Zero playing with like Gojira, I always say Gojira. It's Soundgarden, Mastodon, like he's played with Pantera, he's played with Morbid Angel, like every band you can imagine, like I can only
Metallica,
surmise.
It's a Metallica poster too. Yeah.
Well, yeah, there's that. There's Metallica.
So anyway, what was I saying?
You were talking. You got the record deal, and yeah, I was asking about the writing process.
We got the record deal. God, there's so many good stories there. I should tell you that one too.
Tell us them all.
Well, we got the.
Feel free to go on a sidetrack. You don't have to.
Yeah,
stay.
Corey will edit together like Quentin Tarantino and make it make sense. He hates me already.
Anyway, so we got a deal with Geffen. They were like, "All right, now you guys got to go write the album." You know, because we had some other songs we didn't quite have. Like, Get Some, actually. Title track. There's a few songs we didn't have, like The Box wasn't on there. I don't even think I Just Lie was written yet. So they were like, go write. So we went to rehearsal spot. We had practiced 6 hours a day. We wrote all these songs, which ended up on Get Some. We worked really hard.
What was it like? Like, as far as the songs, was it like, you know, based off a riff, based off a melody? Like, where was your actual
It was different. Yeah. We got in a room. It wasn't like based on a riff or anything. It was like we were literally jamming.
Okay. Yeah.
Old school style, wow. Man. Yeah. Yeah. And we were jamming. And we were like, hey, that's pretty cool. You know?
And I'm sure that explains why your recordings are reflective of the live show. If that's how the actual songs are written and arranged, you know, that, right. That translates.
Yeah. Through. And if you listen to the album, there's actually some jams in between the songs.
Mm, yeah.
You know, they call them interludes. But yeah.
We know all about interludes.
That's our, what we LostSymphony.com.
Yeah. LostSymphony.com.
That's why there's like, even on the first song, Snot, there's a drum solo in the middle of the song out of nowhere, the first song. Like, that's how we did it live. Like,
that's great.
You know, so we recorded it like that on the album. Yeah, so it was a lot of fun, man. We were pretty wild. And then we got in the studio, and I was telling you about how we, Jamie tracked everything without the band. Then we laid down the music. And then Lynn came in, and he had his vocal booth, pretty large vocal booth, actually. It was large. You could probably park a car in it. It was so big.
Wow.
Yeah. He flew in some girls. This is the old days, you know.
Right offable expenses, as they say at Geffen's.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they were girlfriends. They weren't like hookers or nothing, but there were chicks that he, you know, it would,
well, you had to pay an extra $100 a day for anyone that stayed at Longview Farm Studios. I know this for a fact.
I don't even know if that's true when we were there, but they stayed in his room, so it was anyway. So yeah, he would start singing the song, and before you knew it, he'd be butt naked. I'm not kidding. Yeah, he would sing in the booth naked. There'd be a girl in there, she'd be naked. It was like that. It was, and he'd have incense going, his bong going. Sometimes they would just start having sex, and they were like waiting for him. And it was the real deal. It was like some Jim Morrison shit, you know. And actually, you can actually hear some of that on the album. There's a little bit of action on there. We recorded it. Yeah.
Well, that's actually one of the things we said to Ulrich Wilde. I'm such a fan of him. He produced Static X and White Zombie. I said, you know, you have two hits where it starts off with girls just moaning. And every time I hear White Zombie or Static X come on, my mom in the other room, I feel embarrassed.
We mic'd up Lynn's bedroom. We did. Yeah. There's mics behind the bed. You can hear it going on the album. If you listen to the end of,
we call this sound design.
If you listen to the end of, I think it's 313, you can actually pull it up. The very end, there's girl moaning. Yeah, it's real.
Is that stereo mic so you get the full image? Or
flat ones? I forget what they're called, the Z mics or something. They're back
The fact that they were going into a Neve preamp says so much to the coloring of the sound.
Oh, yeah. Right. And then there was a SM... 57 right at the foot of his bed, like right there.
Well, the most important microphone in history.
Yeah, and they don't even know what it's for, and it's live. And we're in the control room listening, going, woo, high five. Oh yeah.
Wow. That's hilarious.
That's something that you will probably never hear again in like modern studios. That's just like not gonna happen.
For sure.
It's just the old days, man. Yeah. It was so cool back then. Like it was so real rock and roll, you know. I got a Jack and Coke. Lynn's banging a chicken there. We're recording it. Tumor's smoking doobies, you know, like.
Well, yeah, and they were cooking you food downstairs because you're in the middle of East Brookfield, Massachusetts. There's nothing going on.
Yeah,
so
we
they
had
make
a,
your
we had
meals
a chef.
For you. Yeah, it's mm-hmm. it was insane that you had your personal chef. They would screen your calls and be like, "Oh yeah, Mikey can't come to the phone right now.
Oh,
Mikey's in no condition to come to the phone."
It right was now. Back then. It was like the real deal, rock and roll. I'm so happy that I got to live that. You know, like. Right. The real rock shit, you know, like they had money and they blew it on us and we didn't care. We're like, all right, do that.
You know? If that was Snot in studio, can you tell us a little bit about Snot on tour?
It was exactly the same thing.
Exactly the same thing.
Yeah, there was a
someone just leaves and said, let me just play the live show without you guys and just fill in the rest.
I mean, when Lynn got butt naked on we're on tour with Ozfest, Limp Bizkit was playing it was Boston and Limp Bizkit was on stage. our record had just come out, and Lynn's like, how am I going to get the attention here, you know? So there was this girl on the stage that was dealing out some BJs to the rock bands, and she was following the fucking show tour around. It was famous. She'd be like down for anything with anybody at any time. Anyway,
sounds exhausting.
You explained that Fred Durst took her out on stage, like with a call around her neck.
No, that's
all
wrong.
Fours. Wasn't it? I thought, isn't that one of the girls?
Continue telling the story. We're gonna mute
Ben. Here's what happened. Limp Bizkit had this 13-foot high prop toilet. It looked like a real toilet you would see in a dirty gas station, but it was 13 feet high and had stairs that would go up so you could stand on the lid of the toilet, like the seat.
Yeah.
You know, so you're a little person on this giant toilet in front of 20,000 people. Pretty cool prop. And Fred would go up there and he'd flush like Britney Spears down the toilet. And back then, Hanson, the little boy band,
yeah,
he flushed them down, and the president or whatever it was. So Lynn grabs this girl that was dealing out BJs
the entire
festival.
The band.
And she was dressed up in the collar and all that you were talking about. But not yet. I'm watching Limp Bizkit front row with our management, with Nick Adler, the manager of our band. And I don't know what's going on. I'm just watching the show. And all of a sudden I see out of the toilet, I see Lynn's head. And then I see his chest with a big giant snot sticker. And then I see him, his butt fucking naked, a dick out, flying 20,000 people. He hasn't got a bit of clothes on. Walks out and he's got this girl with a chain around her collar and the full garb, the dominatrix, I guess you would call it. And she blew him in front of 20,000 people on the Limp Bizkit toilet in front of 20,000 people. I'm in the front row going, everybody's jaw was on the ground because it was happening. She was blown. Yeah. And we're like, oh, we're kicked off the tour for sure. Yeah. So Lynn jumps off the toilet or runs down the back, actually, because it was 13 feet. You get hurt jumping that far. he runs down the toilet. He's naked. He's got his clothes in a little pile kind of on the corner there of the backstage. Grabs his clothes and he's running. Now security's chasing him. He's butt naked. Okay. Yeah. Just got his dick sucked in front of 20,000. And he's running. And he runs into Sharon Osbourne's dressing room with her kids, the Jack Osbourne, Kelly Osbourne. They are like 8 and 10 at the time, maybe 10 and 12. They're young. And they're, you know, naked Lynn, all just totally in front of these kids. And Sharon's like, eyes, you know. And Lynn tells her, I'm so sorry. He'd never met her yet. I'm sorry. I'm running from the police. Help. Actually,
God.
I know. Actually, she was way cool.
Yeah.
You know, it was actually Ozzy's dress. Sharon was in there with the kids.
Mm-hmm.
So he's getting dressed and like, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. And she's like, whatever. It's rock and roll. I mean, their dad is Ozzy.
Right,
I think
right. Seeing him right, naked, right.
I was going to say, Ozzy's dressing room would probably be the appropriate place to run to if you needed advice in that situation.
Right. Nobody could get in. Not even the cops. It's Ozzy's dressing room. They're like, oh, Lynn's in there. And Sharon comes out and tells the cops, all right, I'm going to have him come out. Be cool. So Lynn comes out. They arrest him. You know, it's a lewd act in front of 20,000 people. He can't just do that. They arrest him. They take him to this little, like, on-site jail. And Lynn's got all his clothes on now. You know, and it's outdoor. It's an on-site jail behind a fence with a gate, mm-hmm. You know, and they take him in this gate. I'll tell you the whole story because it's so good.
Yes, please.
They take him in this gate, and Lynn's got weed in his pocket, and he's got a pipe, a glass little pipe, you know, and his little lighter or whatever he has. And anyway, so it's hot. It's the summertime. So they take his handcuffs off. Before they search him, because it's kind of a makeshift jail, there's a big bucket, like a giant bucket, like a bathtub-sized bucket of ice and waters. And Lynn's like, hey, can I grab a water? They're like, go for it, you know? They know he's a rock star. They know he's in trouble, but they're not treating him like a real criminal. So he pulls his weed and his pipe out of his pocket, walks over, reaches into the ice bucket and drops it and pulls out of water because he didn't want to get busted with another, you know, pretty good move, right?
Yeah.
Professional. Yeah.
Crafty. So, yes. So they sit him down. Now people that arrested him left, and they got this clerk there going to take his information and give him his ticket and cite him. Maybe they checked his pockets. I don't really know. But what I do know is when they took his name and stuff, he said he was Dave Mustaine from Megadeth. So the police report went down as Dave Mustaine.
Oh, my gosh.
Which is amazing. Right?
Everything about that was amazing. That was
what a great story, right?
Well, you forgot the funniest part is that it was at a venue named Great Woods.
It was Great Woods, yes. Yeah. I didn't even...
But he had the greatest wood of all time on stage in front of 20,000 people.
But so on the way out, they give him a citation. They say you got to go to court, etc. Okay, fuck off. He's like, hey, can I grab a water? And reaches in and grabs his weed pipe. And leaves.
Oh,
yeah. So later on, they found out, of course, he wasn't Dave Mustaine. You know, and they got the real name. And actually, he got in big trouble for that. They were like, all right, they're going to bury him. And he was actually probably going to actually do some jail time because of the Lewd Act and then that, the name and all that. And this is like right before he passed. He was going to go to court, but he never made it to court to get the sentencing. You know, wow. Well, that's a pretty crazy story.
What happened, you know, in your after he passed and in your life, in your perspective, everything was, you know, kind of looking up and up and up, right? You know, as if you guys are playing these shows, you're on these tours and everything. So what's that like to have such a monumental change in dynamic like that?
We went home off tour and we were sitting around. We had toured like 16 months straight in a van. Well, no, we did do a bus on the Ozfest. We had a bus.
Right.
But I mean, it was pretty heavy, man. It was hard. And so we were going to kind of take a break from touring and just write, you know? So we kind of just started writing when Lynn passed, literally didn't even get a full song yet. And Lynn passed away, you know? So, and we were on MTV every day. We turned on the radio, we'd be on the radio. We were doing it, man. We were blowing the fuck up. It was the real shit, you know? And then when Lynn passed, it was just over. It was done. It was silence. Actually, the label asked us if we'd like to get a new singer, but then we're like, no, it just never be the same without Lynn Strait. You know, because if you listen to that record, it's us jamming with an amazing vocalist. You know, we can't really replace him, you know? So... my beautiful wife just walked in. Hi, baby.
Oh.
Anyway, I promised to cook dinner after this, so I'm going to have to tie this up.
Tie this up. Best dad of the year, finally. He's redeeming himself for sending his child off caffeinated to kill people.
Yes, exactly.
Cook for him, too.
But anyway, right after that happened, Soulfly called. They had a tour in Australia with Korn. And Marilyn Manson called The Big Day Out. It was like 9 dates. Mm-hmm. And Logan Mader had left the band. And they had like 13 days or 8 days to figure out who was going to play guitar on that tour. So they called me.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So they gave me 8 days to learn the entire set. No rehearsals. Flew me to New Zealand to start the tour, which is New Zealand, Australia, Japan. And... I walked on stage in front of 30,000 people in New Zealand without one rehearsal.
Oh my God.
Wow.
Yeah, it was pretty intense. So,
you're obviously a badass though. That's amazing. Yeah.
How did you
that's
get that gig where they just literally said, that's you?
Well, Snot was opening up for Soulfly for months and months, and we became really close with them, you know, and I was close with their crew. And then when Logan left, I don't know what happened between them, but it wasn't real good. And one of the guitar techs told Gloria, hey, what about Mikey Doling? And she's like, yeah, that's a good idea. So they called me and boom, I ended up just doing
it. It's amazing how much relationships, matter.
So yeah. And I flew out there and I kicked ass for them. You know, we did those 9 dates in Australia and New Zealand. And then we did 4 dates in Japan, came home. I thought I was just filling in. And the chemistry was so good. They asked me to stay in the band. And then we did recorded Primitive. Mm-hmm. And then I did another record. I was in the band for about 5 years with them. And then I decided to move on and do my own shit because I was just basically a hired gun.
Yep.
Yeah. You know, and I wanted to write my own music and stuff. So I basically after that. But yeah, it was a good time, man. I love those guys.
It's a crazy journey.
That was my first, really saying that because I remember seeing you with Snot, but then when you came out with Soulfly, I remember thinking to myself, like, I know that guy. And you guys, you had an unbelievable record that had Corey Taylor, I want to say, on it, right? And
Primitive.
The first one you did, and then you did three.
Tom Araya from Slayer.
Yeah, Tom Araya was on it. And it was, dude, I remember the song Jump the Fuck Up the first time I heard it. And I just remember thinking to myself, that's a good idea. And then when I saw you guys live, it's one of those things that, like, I mean, and Sepultura really, always had that, like, Matt Cavalera elicits a response from people that you don't see from almost any other band. And there's almost no way to describe it. Can you explain what that is?
With Matt?
Yeah.
Sepultura was one of the most groundbreaking metal bands of that time. You know, there was that whole Bay Area thrash metal. And then you had Slayer, that was like what thrash was, of course Pantera was out too, but just kind of prior to Pantera breaking, there was Sepultura who came out and fucking floored everybody. Those first records, Beneath, The Remains, Arise, and then they came out with a Chaos AD. Max, he just set himself as a legend at that point. And then, of course, Soulfly, he just started Soulfly. And people looked at Max as like kind of the Bob Marley of heavy metal, and he's an icon. It was a true honor to play with him, definitely. And I just think that's where the fans were with him. He's very legendary,
Yeah. Well, listen, Mikey, we appreciate your time. I know you got to go make dinner.
I got a family.
Like there's so many other questions and so much more to your story that we'd love to hear. I hope you'll come back and join us at some point.
If you want to do that with Shannon, I think we're talking about maybe doing a dual interview with Shannon.
That would be amazing. Why don't you ask him so that we can send him a video and say, Shannon, because when Shannon said that, I sent David the video, and then he said to tell Shannon it was cool, but it's not the same coming from me.
You know what? I'll do something later for you. I'll record something on my phone and send it to you.
Sounds great.
So is there anything that, before you leave, Mikey?
Yeah.
Is there things that people can check out?
Anything you want to promote? Anything you want to promote?
Like, give us all of that, please.
Well, like I said, you could just look up Channel Zero, the band.be, and you can find our website. BE is for Belgium. Mm-hmm. They're from there. And then my new project, Wyote, that I'm doing with Aaron Nordstrom, that's going to be coming out probably summer, I would think. Because Gemini Syndrome has a new album right now. We're letting them put that out and let the fans digest it before we go putting something else out by Aaron as a side project. So, we'll get that going. So that's about it for now. Okay. We're attempting to do a Snot documentary right now. We got a director and stuff, but it's kind of in the infant stages. I'll let you know later if that starts taking shape.
Cool. Love to hear about it.
Yeah, it sounds fantastic.
And thank you so much, really, truly.
Thank you.
Dude, it's come
full
circle.
Yeah, it was great getting to know you.
If you haven't figured it out.
That is such a cool picture.
It's been
man.
On my wall since 1998 or 99.
So really. Cute.
We've both changed a little bit.
I think a little bit more hair over there, less hair over here.
Definitely. Okay, right, Mike, guys.
Thank you so much. 2020-D.com.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, as always, for listening to this episode of 2020. As mentioned, please visit 2020-D.com. Like and subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss out on future episodes. This week's throwback clip is from episode number 56, featuring the one and only David Ellefson of Megadeth. Check it out.
Yeah, look, there's the obvious drug addictions, and, those are obviously serious and, life-changing. And, in fact, I remember when I was in rehab, they said, David, there's only one thing you have to change, and that's everything. And I was like, whoa.
Wow.
You know what I mean? Yeah, and that's
heavy. That's a heavy task.
Yeah, and at right around that time, a lot of famous people that we all know were getting sober. So fortunately, there was a sobriety enthusiasm and community, and people were, the managers and the labels, everybody's done dumping millions of dollars into drugged out rock stars. Like, those days were over. This was late 80s. So people were getting clean. People were either dying or they're getting clean, you know?
Ever wonder what a punch from Elton John feels like?
Or how you'd cope with having turned down the chance to be in Nirvana?
Or what signal Keith Richards gives when he wants you to get the hell out of his hotel room?
Fans of Too Much Effie Perspective don't have to wonder, because they've heard these exact stories and a jillion others on our podcast. I'm Alex Hoffman, former tour manager for Radiohead.
And I'm musician and comedy writer Alan Keller. On the TMEP show, we get guests like Nancy Wilson from Heart, Jeremiah Freights from The Lumineers, and Modern Family's Julie Bowen to tell us things they may have only shared with their therapist, clergy, or a TMZ stringer.
So join us on Too Much Effing Perspective. That's EFFING Perspective, the only podcast you crank up to 11.